He's just published a novel titled Sting of the Drone. He recently served on President Obama's advisory panel on NSA spying. If you'd like a copy of today's show, go to democracynow.org. Also on our website, you can watch our interview with the longtime Japanese-American civil rights activist Yuri Kochiyama, who's died at the age of 93. She talks about being with Malcolm X when he was assassinated in 1965, as well as her time living in a Japanese internment camp in World War II with her family. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Samal Kofani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield, Cassandra Lazare, Messiah Rhodes, and Trina Ndura, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, John Wallach, Vesta Godars, and our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Krug-Meadows, Carla DeJesus, and Phil Raymond. Special thanks also to Brenda Mira, to Neil Shabata, and Isis Phillips, and Jamie Hill. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is more talk radio with our hosts Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. Today's guest is writer and historian Gerald Horn, author of the new book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. But first, I must remind you that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the 27th Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival, July 3 through 6 at Waterfront Park, which benefits Oregon Food Bank and features Greg Allman, Boz Scaggs, Los Lobos, Maceo Parker, Bombino, Charlie Musselwhite, Ivan Neville's Dumpster Funk, and many more. Information and complete schedule and pass information at waterfrontbluesfest.com.
In My Life, a musical theater tribute to the Beatles, is the nationally touring musical biography of the Beatles through the eyes of manager Brian Epstein, featuring the live music of renowned tribute band Abbey Road. The smash hit production performs at Newmark Theater on Friday, June 6th at 7:30 p.m. inside of the Antoinette Hatfield Hall at 1111 Southwest Broadway, Portland, Oregon. More than just a Beatles tribute concert, In My Life gives the audience a chance to be there at pivotal events in the extraordinary career of the Beatles. More information on this KBOO-sponsored event may be found on kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Voices on the Ground, Resistance and Resilience, with a keynote speaker on June 6th and all-day conference June 7th at Portland State University. Voices on the Ground is hosted by the Social Welfare Action Alliance and the School of Social Work at PSU, with the goal of providing space for the larger community of activists and organizations to connect and engage students and the broader community in an effort to build meaningful, collaborative relationships. Again, that's Voices on the Ground, Resistance and Resilience, June 6th and 7th at Portland State University. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio here in Portland 90.7, in Hood River 91.9, and in Corvallis 104.3 on your FM dial. And via the World Wide Web, it is kboo.fm. This is More Talk Radio, and we thank you for joining us on this Monday, June 2nd, 2014. My name is Cecil Prescott. We are pleased to have with us an important guest and interview that we think that will be something that you will enjoy and learn from. Here in the U.S., we are in the midst of our annual six-week period of honoring in the history and meaning of the U.S. Republic. Beginning with Memorial Day and extending to the 4th of July, this country celebrates and pays homage to what can be termed as our creation myth. While many now acknowledge that the instigators of the American Revolutions were not perfect, forefathers such as Virginian Washington and Jeffersons were, after all, slaveholders, the principles of the revolutions were correct with a moral trajectory which led to a more perfect union. Well, that ain't necessarily so. Our guest this morning, Professor Gerald Horn, the Moores Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, has published a recent volume that challenged many of our common assumptions. In the Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, he offers an insightful review and analysis of the causes leading up to the incidents in the late 18th century, and offer a new perspective in which to view the history of this nation. We are pleased to have joining us this morning Dr. Horn. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I appreciate your book so much, and I want to encourage lots of people to pick it up because I think it offers indeed insights and a new perspective on for many in terms of what many have said, and I think you write so eloquently about our creation myth. And I would like to start off by you saying something a little bit about the common understanding of what happened in the American colonies in the 18th century, and how you offer a slightly different perspective in which to view those incidents.
Well, as your prefatory comments very well suggested, it is commonly understood in the United States of America that the revolt against British rule on July 4th, 1776, leading to the creation of the United States, involved these Olympian founding fathers, capital O, capital F, capital F, men like this we've never seen the likes before, who revolted against tyranny in London and established a wondrous constitution with liberty and justice for all. I tell a different story. The simplified summary of my argument is that when you had Somerset's case in London in June 1772, which fundamentally abolished slavery in England, it seemed to suggest that this ruling would be extended across the Atlantic, thereby jeopardizing millions of dollars in slave property. It needs to be understood that slavery was not a sideshow with regard to the United States in the late 18th century or even in 1861 when the Civil War erupted. First of all, the profits for the slave trade were eye-watering and eye-popping, sometimes 1,600%. As you know, in today's United States, there are those who will sell their firstborn for a 1,600% profit. Not only that, but then these profits were poured into allied industries, such as shipping, such as banking, such as insurance. Not only that, but in order to forestall slave revolts, particularly in a place like South Carolina, which endured an African majority for a good deal of its early history, it was necessary to build roads and bridges, etc., so that militia could be easily dispatched to plantations to squash slave rebellions. Now, this infrastructure, like roads and bridges, was also useful to economic development generally. So when Somerset's case erupted, it seemed to send a troubling signal that led to revolt. That's the simple argument. Of course, as the minutes wear on this program, we can get into more detail.
Excellent. That's so much so. And I think what you also do in the book is expand our ways in which to view the incidents in the 18th century by expanding how we view popularly, we often think of the American Revolution as something that happens within the 13 colonies. And I think many times we do not reference what was going on. So as you suggested, the Somerset case, but also you, in your book, you offer, you widen our perspective by even going back to, you know, what is known as the Glorious Revolution of 1688 in England, and how that began the mercantile class new relationship with the monarchy, but also began what we might call today as the free trade.
You are correct. The Glorious Revolution of 1688 fundamentally, for our purposes here, involved a step forward for the rising merchant class and a step back for the monarchy. With regard to the slave trade, this led to an erosion of the monopoly enjoyed by the Royal African Company, which theretofore had been under the thumb of the monarchy, and an opening of what has been described as free trade in Africans. That is to say, the slave trade was deregulated, and it was opened up to a rising class of merchants who thereby descended upon Africa like maniacally crazed bees, manacling and handcuffing and enchaining every African in sight, dragging them across the Atlantic. They were particularly dragged to the Caribbean, which up until the mid 18th century was seen in London as more valuable than the North American mainland. However, the expansion exponentially of the African slave trade in many ways was a catastrophic victory. On the one hand, certainly it profited many handsomely, not only in London, but in the colonies as well. But secondly, and perhaps more importantly, it led to slave revolts. That is to say, in Jamaica, Antigua, Barbados in particular, you had a tremendous explosion and expansion of slave revolts that fundamentally threatened the entire colonial project. In the 1730s, London found itself in the very difficult position of negotiating with, quote, Maroons, unquote, that is to say Africans who had taken over a good deal of Jamaica, and basically according them a certain kind of diplomatic recognition, which infuriated many planters, not only on the mainland, but in the Caribbean, of course, itself. And it also suggested that what had befallen Spain in the middle of the 17th century, when the Maroons had chased them out of Jamaica, thereby allowing London to come in, that London's colonial project, too, could be overturned in Jamaica in the 1730s, and thereby setting off a chain effect that could then ricochet into Barbados, Antigua, and perhaps to the mainland itself. I think that one of the problems with previous histories, as your question suggested, is that colonial history, as is written in the United States today, is oftentimes treated like pre-U.S. history. Mm-hmm. That is to say, they only look at the 13 colonies before 1776 and don't seem to recognize that the colonial empire of London included Jamaica, Antigua, Barbados. They were all ruled from one capital, that is to say, London. There were interconnections between the two. A number of the founding fathers actually were born in the Caribbean, including Alexander Hamilton, who you may carry a picture of on a daily basis as he's on your U.S. currency. Not only that, but a number of other leaders of the revolt against British rule were born in Antigua, which basically was an island that was continually on fire and aflame, including liquidation plots whereby the Africans were seeking to rise up and massacre all the Europeans and take over themselves, which of course caused these European settlers to flee to the mainland, where the contradictions of colonialism and slavery basically multiplied.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm here with Celeste Carey, and our guest this morning is Gerald Horn, author of a new volume entitled The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America.
Dr. Horn, could you place the development, both economically with regards to slavery and the revolt, in a timeline with what was going on with the colonies. Because for many people, I think that timeline is a little confusing. It seems out of sync to have, on one hand, the revolt of the Africans who were enslaved in the Caribbean, and yet what seemed to be a relatively, and emphasis on relative peaceful and calm progression in the United States, or I should say the 13 colonies.
Well, first of all, that second statement with regard to relative peace is not altogether accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Recall that there were major slave revolts in the 13 colonies on the mainland, 1712 in New York, 1739 in South Carolina, perhaps the bloodiest of them all, when dozens of settlers were massacred by Africans, 1741 in New York again. Now, with regard to the specifics of each of these revolts, they also carry very striking signals. That is to say, all of those slave revolts that I just referenced involved Africans on the mainland collaborating with the foes of London. 1712 in New York, for example, there were French fingerprints all over that revolt. That is to say, the French in neighboring Quebec were collaborating with the Africans against their mutual foe, that is to say, British settlements. 1739 in South Carolina, the Africans who were involved in that particular revolt, number one, were disproportionately Angolan, a country, as you know, in southwestern Africa, where the art of warfare was not necessarily unknown, and in fact was basically involved in warfare up until the latter part of the 20th century, as you well know. The Africans from Angola, number one, many of them spoke Portuguese, which is very similar to Spanish, and there hangs a tale, because you can't understand the threats to the North American colonies without understanding the threat from Spanish Florida. As you probably know, Florida was controlled by the Spanish for many decades and centuries, and like the French in Quebec, they collaborated with the Africans in South Carolina against their mutual foes, the British settlements. Number two, the conflict between these European powers takes place in the context of a so-called religious Cold War. There were the so-called Catholic powers, that is to say, the Spanish and the French, versus the Protestant power in London. The Angolans, for example, who had been colonized by the Portuguese going back to the early 1500s, were disproportionately Catholic as well, and their language, Portuguese, that is to say the Portuguese language was also spoken in Angola, was very common and similar to Spanish, which facilitated collaboration between Spanish Florida and the Africans in South Carolina. And likewise, if you look at Manhattan in 1741, you have Spanish fingerprints all over that, particularly the Spanish from colonial Cuba. So I think that this idea that somehow the mainland was peaceful while the Caribbean was afire is not altogether accurate or precise.
So why would you say that myth persists along with our creation myth?
Well, I'm sure you can answer that question as well as I can. I mean, people, not only in the United States but elsewhere, they create mythologies that are soothing, that allow them to whistle past the graveyard, that allows for a certain kind of national unity. It has been felt that if the... Now I'm just supposing here, I'm speculating, because I haven't interrogated the historians who've written these histories. But I suspect that when... If you look, for example, at some of these slave revolts that I just mentioned, even though the record from the 18th century is clear that there was European collaboration with the Africans, if you look at the contemporary histories written, they don't mention that. Now, why is that? I guess they're writing a pre-U.S. history. They're writing a history where, I guess, it's felt to be comfortable that Africans are rising up and then getting splattered and the Europeans emerge triumphant. And I guess that even though that does disservice to African history, I guess it does a service to U.S. history in helping to forge a certain kind of inauthentic national unity that's convenient for the purposes of some in 2014.
One of the things, as we explore how we continue to hold on to these myths, one myth that continues is that, well, we know that the American Revolution was incomplete, and that it did not reach its moral point or moral trajectory until maybe the American Civil War. And even though the American Civil War, for those who on the North, was not initially a fight against slavery, eventually Lincoln and others became enlightened, and it became a war for the freedom of those who were enslaved. I think one thing that I gained from reading your book is not only is that not necessarily true, but in fact, and you make a strong argument that the Confederacy was the natural heirs of the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. Could you say how those who were leaders in the Confederacy thought that they were living out or fulfilling what they thought was the mission and the purpose of the American Revolution?
And of the original colonies, even if you get to it.
Well, as your comments have suggested, the founders of the United States of America in 1776, many of them were slaveholders themselves, Jefferson and Washington in the first place. And so it's logical and understandable why those who rebelled against the United States in 1861 thought that they were merely exemplifying the legacy of Jefferson and Washington. There's a second point I'd like to add here, because at times, a place like Oregon, which was not part of the 13 colonies, feels far distant from this kind of story that I'm telling. But you may know that before I published this book, I wrote a book called Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans of the British Empire Fight the United States Before Emancipation, where I did a lot of research in Portland at the Historical Society in downtown Portland, and including the state capitol in Salem. And there's an interesting story about the history of Oregon there, and I'm sure you know this living out there, about the attempt to ban Africans from Oregon on the principle, in part, that the Africans would collaborate with the indigenous population against European settlers, thereby jeopardizing the security of the state of Oregon, which basically enters the Union approximately 150 years ago.
With the plan of being a white homeland on top of that.
Well, of course, of course. And this, of course, in a sense, is consistent with the founding of the United States, because as I say in the book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Georgia, the state of Georgia, which its 2010 census showed has more black people than any other state in the Union, started off in 1733 as a so-called white homeland, to use your term. It was to be a buffer, a Berlin Wall, if you like, separating Spanish Florida from South Carolina, and thereby helping to blunt the thrust from St. Augustine, Florida, spearheaded by African soldiers, because, of course, Spain had incorporated Africans into their military as early as the 1500s, which puts competitive pressure on Britain to do the same. And when Britain begins to do the same, this outrages and enrages the settlers, who, of course, felt that putting arms in the hands of Africans was inconsistent with their aim of enslaving Africans and thereby leading to the revolt against British rule in July 1776. So in some ways, what I'm trying to suggest to you right now is that even the history of Oregon on the Pacific coast of the United States, not coming into the Union until decades after 1776, in many ways is consistent with the narrative that I'm putting forward.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 along the Columbia River Gorge, along the Willamette River Valley. It is 104.3, and on the web, www.kboo. We're speaking today with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. Join the conversation. This is a good chance to fill in the history that you did not learn and understand a little bit more about the roots of political parties that we experience these days with their deep-held conservative views, and why some of the frustration and anger run so deep within the black community. 503-231-8187. You've pointed out something that I think is really important and is both hard to grasp but very necessary to grasp, and that's the shifting political climate that we saw. You've got the French trying to oust the Spanish trying to oust the French, both of them trying to oust the British, and each one of them in turn deciding on whether or not to exploit and capitalize on the frustrations of the Africans who are enslaved here. And then you've also made a really important point earlier in the show when you talked about the fact that we know that in terms of cheap labor, the slave trade really benefited the United States. But the fact that you had these shifting alliances and the fact that the slave trade was so profitable that its profits could be turned into other industries, without understanding how slavery benefited all aspects of our economy and our development, it's kind of hard to understand this very deep-seated grasp, almost white-knuckle grasp on slavery. Can you talk a little bit about how the shifting alliance and the depth of support that slavery gave our economy really is manifested in some of our political policies nowadays?
Well, point number one, to be fair, I think, upon the work of previous scholars who have made the point embedded in your question.
Yes, definitely.
In other words, If you look at the work of the founding father of Trinidad and Tobago, Eric Williams, Capitalism and Slavery, the late Guyanese historian Walter Rodney, How Europe Developed Africa, for example, or even the contemporary Nigerian historian at the University of Rochester, Joseph Irikori, and his book, prize-winning book, in fact, that came out a few years ago on how slavery helped to fuel the Industrial Revolution in the British Isles, it's clear that there is a close connection between the rise of the slave trade, free trade in Africans in the late 17th century, and the rise of capitalism, which basically enters on the world stage with the blood of Africans basically emerging from every pore. And it's one of the reasons, perhaps, why you'll see this historical fact that many Africans today, or at least some of the more enlightened, I might say, tend to take a rather jaundiced view of the system of capitalism, since it was built fundamentally up on their backs. I think you also mentioned what you refer to as this white-knuckle grasp, and I think that was a telling phrase, because I also tell a story in this book that also builds upon the work, I believe, of previous scholars in terms of the construction of whiteness, which was very essential to the development of the United States of America. I call it the original identity politics, albeit in a militarized form. That is to say, how was it that people who were defined on the east bank of the Atlantic as English and Irish and Scots and Welsh, somehow magically, when they come to the west bank of the Atlantic, they're white, for example? Now, obviously, this is an elongated historical process. Other historians whose work I built upon suggest that it's totally embedded in the narrative of the rise of the slave trade, that is to say, this new racial category is essential to ousting the indigenous from their land and stocking that land with Africans, and that is to say that this project, in many ways, it surpassed and transcended the previous conflict, which was the religious Cold War. That is to say, when the Spanish were colonizing, oftentimes with regard to their colonies in the Americas, they mandated that the colonists must be Spanish, and sometimes they mandated that the colonists must be Spanish Catholics. Whereas if you look at the United States, they transcended the religious Cold War, at least in a formal sense, in their First Amendment to their wondrous Constitution, which mandated religious liberty, which we all know was oftentimes violated because anti-Catholicism and anti-Semitism continued to percolate in the United States for decades, perhaps even to this very day. But at least in theory, the idea was that any who had roots in Europe from the Atlantic Ocean to the Ural Mountains in Russia were considered to be white and thereby could have a certain kind of first-class citizenship. This also points to why this very lazy and easy thinking that the principles established with the founding of this so-called republic in 1776 could easily be transferred to the rest of us, it's not necessarily accurate, because in order to attract these newly minted whites to a war zone, which was what North America was, with Native Americans on the warpath and Africans alongside them, you had to basically offer enticements, inducements, and emoluments. Now, part of that would be expropriated land, stocked with Africans, and then part of the package as well would be certain kinds of civil liberties, which would be attractive to these would-be migrants, but certainly were not guaranteed to the Africans. And if you look at our imprisonment rates today, if you look at the number of people who are disproportionately cited on death row, an argument could be made that these principles still have not necessarily been extended in toto to the Africans. And then, if you look very carefully at my book, you'll find quotes from leading Londoners and British officials in the 1770s, as Britain is moving towards abolition, not least because of the competitive pressure placed upon London by the fact that Spain had been arming the Africans, you'll see that Britain is willing to make concessions to the Africans in terms of trial by jury and other kinds of civil liberties that, to a degree, we were deprived of until at least the middle part of the 20th century. So I think that too often our contemporary analysts have taken an easy way out with this sort of lazy thinking that these principles of the Constitution could be easily extended, and not realizing that these principles were in many ways established to foil our upsurge. It's almost as if you were saying that Nelson Mandela's jailers should be given the credit for his liberation. I don't think that makes any sense.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. Our guest this morning is Gerald Horn, author of The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. This is an insightful volume that clarifies the history of this nation and offers a perspective that many of us did not receive when we were in schools. I wanted to go back a little bit to the point you were making earlier in terms of slave resistance in the United States and getting beyond the myth that the enslaved populations were docile here in the United States. Could you say something more about in terms of the attitudes of enslaved Africans and in different parts of the 13 colonies, and perhaps say something about how they responded to the Revolutionary War, or how could they respond to what was happening?
Well, if you look at previous histories with regard to slave revolts, interestingly enough, the leading work continues to be a book written in 1944 to show you how derelict historians have been in examining this subject. I'm speaking of Herbert Aptheker's American Negro Slave Revolts, which is still a useful text, even though it was published over 70-odd years ago. But in many ways, I think that even Aptheker, and he of course has now passed away, fell into this trap of looking for sort of pitched armies of Africans facing off against pitched armies of Europeans, not unlike what you saw in South Carolina in Stono's Revolt in 1739. And then other historians took the point of view with, if you didn't have a Stono-type revolt, well, that meant that the Africans were docile. In other words, they didn't organize in armies and face off against Europeans organizing armies. That meant the slave revolts were largely absent. But what about arson, for example? And here's a word to younger scholars, budding scholars in your audience. We need a study with regard to how enslaved Africans used arson in order to destabilize settlements. We also need a study with regard to how enslaved Africans used herbs and poisons to poison their slave masters. And when that study is done, one of the points that probably will emerge is that women played a significant role in terms of the use of poisons and herbs to attack their oppressors, and I might also say our oppressors, if you look at shipboard insurrections. Now, interestingly enough, there is this idea sort of floating around somehow that, I guess, you know, the Africans in Angola and Guinea, et cetera, they just sort of willingly walked into the ships and laid down and got transported across the Atlantic, which is, you know, it's lunacy. I mean, if somebody came to Portland and tried to chain people and drag them to China, I think people would be fighting every step of the way. And certainly that was the case with regard to the Africans dragged across the Atlantic. Shipboard insurrections were skyrocketing, particularly as the African slave trade began to accelerate in the first few decades of the 18th century with the newly enunciated policy of free trade in Africans. Not only that, but I cite instances where the script was flipped and that the European enslavers, in turn, were enslaved in Africa by the Africans. And, of course, that doesn't even get into a story that you're probably familiar with regard to how in the early 19th century in North Africa, I'm sure you know this, the hymn from the shores of Montezuma. From the halls of Montezuma.
Shores of Tripoli, right.
Sorry about that. Well, that was referring to the fact that in North Africa, for decades previously, the North Africans have been enslaving Europeans. And then, of course, oftentimes they'd be shipped off to slave markets in Eastern Europe. So, you know, I think that for some, it's like whistling past the graveyard. They want a history that's calming, that doesn't bring up these unfortunate moments, that doesn't necessarily infuriate these Negroes, because, you know, the Negroes are,
wild, hot-blooded people. Right.
Los Angeles in 1992 and Los Angeles in 1965 and Harlem in 1964. They'll go on the warpath, so you don't want to
upset the colored folks, I know. You know, it's funny you mentioned these. A few months ago, we interviewed author of the book, The Empire of Necessity, which talked about how a slave insurrection had taken over a ship and that the slaves almost got away. And then I guess it was last year in the fall, we featured the book We Will Shoot Back. And, you know, in listening to your book, reading your book, listening to the conversations, one of the things that comes to mind when you talk about why this narrative, this myth persists, is it helps dislocate that anger and that frustration, and it helps diminish the righteousness of that anger and frustration, so that it appears both new and whimsical, almost as though it has no roots in any long-term indenture and suffrage.
And there's another point too that should be added, because I'm sure some of your listeners right now might be a bit quizzical, because listening to me, they might say, well, then how was it that we got to this point in 2014 where, you know, we're talking on the radio about this sort of thing? And one of the points that I brought forward in this book and in previous books that I've written is that other than the struggles of Africans themselves against oppression, a key to our liberation has been our ability to forge alliances with those who share the same antagonists and foes that we do.
Okay, Dr. Horn, let me have you hold that thought, because that really leads to some relationships we have now. And we've got a patient caller, and I really want you to have a full opportunity to explore that, because I'm fascinated by how modern-day policies toward Native Americans have continued out of these alliances. You are listening to More Talk Radio. Join us in the conversation with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of The Counter-Revolution of 1776, 503-231-8187. Good morning, Harry.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I have two questions for you. The first question is, our founding fathers wrote a lot about freedom and democracy and everything, but they owned slaves. Did they put in their writings what they thought about the slaves? Because they had to purchase them, they had to discipline them, and things like that. in their writings, did they say anything about how they thought about them and Native Americans?
Well, absolutely they did. Look at Thomas Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia, which you can find at any library and perhaps even order from eBay or Amazon. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, a signal founding father of this so-called republic, had very disgusting and despicable attitudes about Africans. Not only that, but given the sort of glorification of these so-called founding fathers, you can go to certainly the University of Oregon Library in Eugene, Oregon, and perhaps the Portland State University Library, and found printed in bound volumes of the papers and writings of all the founding fathers, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, Hamilton. And most of these guys speak at length and rather, I might say honestly, about their rather hostile attitudes towards Africans and people who are indigenous.
But you never hear their quotes. No one ever quotes them saying, what, Jefferson said that? Washington said that? You're kidding. But you never hear these quotes.
Well, if you pick up my book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, you'll be able to read in profusion about this sort of thing.
Okay, thank you. My second question is, hopefully you'll do a book on Lewis and Clark. And when they came to the Northwest, they purchased the Louisiana Purchase from France. And when they came, they made sure they stayed on the south side of the Columbia because the British were in Fort Vancouver, and they never visited them because the British probably would have shot them for being out of uniform. Also, we had a French community called Champouy on the Willamette River. They never went to visit them. They beelined it to the Columbia River, at the mouth of the Columbia River, stuck a flag for 1 year, and then left. And it seemed that their main purchase, their main thought was to find out if the British or the French had armed the Indians here in the Northwest.
Point number one is that a lot of U.S. history needs to be rewritten, which is going to keep a lot of younger scholars in business for decades to come, which I'm sure is good news in this era of unemployment. Point number two is that my previous book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, as noted, deals with what we now refer to as the Pacific Northwest. I mean, for example, in Seattle, just north of where you're sitting, there's this mythology about George W. Bush, not the former president, but supposedly the first Negro settler.
Yes. Right.
And basically, like many Africans, he was coming to that part of North America to escape U.S. jurisdiction.
Right.
Basically, U.S. jurisdiction follows him, and so they take over, and then somehow he becomes part of the narrative as being the first settler. He becomes like a U.S. patriot, when actually he was trying to escape the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of the many reasons, to return to point one, why a lot of history needs to be rewritten.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call. And we have another caller, but he almost gave us a perfect segue here with arming the Native Americans here. We get this next caller, and then I want to launch into that because I think it's really important to recognize not only how alliances were shifted and exploited, but again, how some of those alliances and the punishment for those alliances are reflected in current day U.S. policies, domestic policies. We'll go to our next caller, LJ.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you guys?
It's Monday.
Yes, it is Monday. Thank you so much for this dialogue. Just a couple of real quick things. The successful slave rebellion in Haiti by Toussaint, his last name escapes me, but they had a very successful uprising against the French, and they, in truth and in fact, did get their freedom, but it's my understanding that they were forced to pay reparations to France because of the loss of money that the French would have felt as a result of that rebellion, and if we can touch on that. And speaking of reparation, there was an article recently in the Atlantic Monthly making a case for reparation for Afro-Americans who did, in fact, generate enormous wealth for this country, never, ever being compensated. The recent case of J.P. Morgan Chase and the subprime mortgages targeting people of color, and I do think there's some litigation going on right now, and your feelings about reparation, and I certainly will take my answers off the air, and thank you so much for the show.
You launched a couple of mouthfuls there.
Okay. Go ahead, Professor.
Well, first of all, with regards to the Haitian Revolution, I'm in the process of writing a book on this subject, that is to say how the United States confronted the Haitian Revolution taking place between 1791 and 1804, the only successful slave revolt that most of us know about that established the first black republic on the island of Hispaniola. I also talk about in this book what happens in the 1840s when, with U.S. assistance, the Dominican Republic comes into existence. As you know, Haiti and the Dominican Republic share the island of Hispaniola, and it was 1844 that the DR seceded from Haiti, not least because of U.S. assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that puts a new spin upon, I think, the history of the Dominican Republic, and a subject that may be of interest to your listeners, given the role of Dominican baseball players, not least of the Seattle Mariners. With regard to reparations, I've written a bit on that subject, but the point I would like to stress is the point I was making earlier, is that given the fact that polls show, unsurprisingly, that a considerable number of U.S. nationals are hostile to reparations, the lesson of our history has been that you have to lengthen the battlefield. You just can't make this a total U.S. story. You have to link up, for example, with the reparations lawsuit brought by the Caribbean nations led by St. Vincent suing London, suing Britain in London, for example. You have to take it to the United Nations, which, of course, many radicals did in the early 1950s, including the great Paul Robeson. But as long as this reparations discourse remains solely a provincial U.S. discourse,
and fragmented,
I don't see it's going anywhere.
Well, it's also not articulated in the broader sense. You know, it's articulated in terms of a personal sense, or at least in it for popular consciousness. It was articulated in a personal sense, like I'm going to get my 40 acres and a mule, and you know, which translates to money. And it's not looked at in a broader sense, such as maybe educational or financial opportunities. But
well, I just wanted to see if you could expand a little bit more, since you mentioned it, in terms of what's happening in the Caribbean.
Yes.
Because I'm fascinated by what's and where it might lead.
Well, first of all, a prefatory note, St. Vincent, a small island in the Caribbean, historically has been a citadel of resistance to European colonialism. You may know that in St. Vincent, the Africans fundamentally allied and merged with the indigenous population and fought off the British and the French to the point where many of them were then deported to Central America, where they formed the population today we know as the Garifuna, who you may know have migrated to the west coast of the United States of America, in the area stretching from San Diego to Seattle. St. Vincent has been the leader in getting the Caribbean nations, including Jamaica, Haiti, Barbados, Antigua, etc., in terms of bringing a lawsuit against Britain for reparations. Recall that when Britain abolished slavery circa 1833, 1834, they compensated the slave owners and almost went into bankruptcy to do so. No compensation whatsoever to the enslaved. This lawsuit that I'm referring to comes on the heels of a more or less successful lawsuit brought by the so-called Mau Mau veterans in colonial Kenya and East Africa, who sued in British courts as a result of the depredations inflicted upon them during that very brutal war in the 1950s. And by the way, I wrote a book about that called Mau Mau in Harlem, The United States and Liberation of Kenya, for those seeking further details. So it's incumbent upon people of African descent to not be unaware of these issues that are going to the heart of our future and our destiny and our fate in North America.
Dr. Horn, can you touch upon, we don't have a lot of time, but I really want folks to hear about both the alliances we formed with the indigenous allies here, both here in the North American, but in the Caribbean American as well, but also the fact that the Aboriginal population suffered for having made those alliances, especially in Florida and Georgia.
I'm glad you mentioned Florida. In my book that I reference, Negro Comrades of the Crown, where I talk about the history of Oregon, I quote one of the so-called founding fathers of Oregon as being part of the United States, and one of the reasons he wanted to keep Africans out of Oregon was he pointed to the conflict in Florida involving the people we refer to as the Seminoles, who between, say, 1818 to 1856 fought three of the bloodiest wars that the United States was ever involved in, before many of them were deported to Mexico along with their African allies. Mm-hmm. And this so-called founding father of Oregon felt that if you allowed Africans into Oregon in the middle of the 19th century, they would basically imitate the Africans in Florida and merge with the native population, the indigenous population, and wage war against the settlers and the colonists. And this, of course, was an accurate perception, because the history of North America is replete with alliances between the indigenous and the Africans. In the Counter-Revolution of 1776 book, I talk about the alliance between the indigenous and the Africans in colonial South Carolina, circa 1715, in the so-called Yamasee War, which basically almost overturned the entire colonial project in South Carolina. Once again, we need the younger scholars and the budding scholars to delve more deeply into this history that, to a degree, has not been written.
You are listening to More Talk Radio. This is your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. We're speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, who's the author of many books, many recent books, matter of fact. But we're talking to him today about the Counter-Revolution of 1776, slave resistance, and the origins of the United States of America, and I might add, and the origins of modern-day Southern-based conservancy. But we do have a caller here online, and good morning, David.
Greetings from San Francisco.
Hey. Oh, well, thank you.
You know, I wonder if your guest is familiar with something called the Hazard Letter. I've only run into a few people that have ever heard of it, and I'm trying to get attribution on it. Apparently, the Hazard Letter was written to the Confederacy probably in the 1850s, basically telling them not to worry about renouncing slavery, because the company store model was better. You could basically trick people into thinking that they were free, but you would make more money with the company store. Are you familiar with the Hazard Letter?
Not familiar with the Hazard Letter, but obviously the history of the South, in particular after the end of the Civil War, basically speaks to the point that the kind of sharecropping and debt slavery that emerges in Dixie in many ways replicates the worst aspects of slavery, and not least being the convict lease system, where people are arrested for very minor and trivial offenses and then leased out
right
to work for plantation owners. And they don't get paid because they're prisoners, but the state gets paid. The state of Louisiana gets paid, for example. Indeed, many scholars today draw a straight line from the history of slavery to the history of imprisonment, which the United States, of course, has some of the highest imprisonment rates of any country in the world, with black men and black women in particular being major victims, to the degree that some say that black people in North America are the most heavily imprisoned population on planet Earth.
Yeah, I've heard that as recently, as well as with our, we're now what, 2.5 million prisoner population, and it was a scandal when they were even talking about 1 million people 20 years ago. So to be at 2.5 million at this point, we are the most imprisoned population. And I was just reading some more about that. The prisoner rentals, so to speak. You know, one other thing, I agree and disagree on some of the founding fathers. I look at it I have an old great-great-great-grandpappy who signed the Declaration. That was John Hart of New Jersey. And the whole idea of being able to finally beat the king and create our own republic was a huge thing. It was impossible to believe that it ever came about. And the courage it took to actually fight a monarchy and win was massive. It was, of course, advanced in Haiti before America, or before the United States. But the idea that those guys never quit, it was the Hazard Letter was put together in the 1850s, but apparently there were British who convinced the Confederates to go ahead and secede because the monarchies wanted to split up the country so that they could reinvade. And, of course, Cinco de Mayo, most people think that it was Mexican Independence Day, but it was actually that the French, during the American Civil War, as monarchists, the French were trying to capture Mexico so that they could reinstill monarchy in the Americas. And so the idea that we've been fighting monarchies, you could even see World War One as the protection of the monarchies with the death of Archduke Ferdinand. Why in the world would America get involved in World War One except to protect an archduke who was pretty much a scoundrel? And so, there are even many of the neocons and Tea Party types can be convinced that the monarchies are still trying to attack America by the management and ownership of the Federal Reserve. So the idea that
caller, thank you so much for your points, but you've overloaded us and we're out of time. Thank you so much. Dr. Horn, before you go, any parting words, both in terms of encouraging people to learn more, but just about what you see as playing out in modern politics and policies?
Well, first of all, with regard to the caller, one of the reasons I wrote this book is I think there needs to be more self-criticism of the United States. You have people in the United States who are critical of every revolution since the late 18th century, be it the French Revolution, particularly the Cuban Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Iranian Revolution. But with regard to the so-called revolution on these shores, they don't have a peep to say about it. You would think that this revolt against monarchy involved all upside and no downside, which is obviously ridiculous. So I'm hoping that this book would cause people to take a second look, not only at this so-called revolution, but their persistent critiques of other revolutions. It seems to be rather one-sided. And then the second point to reiterate, I think that with regard to the descendants of enslaved Africans and the indigenous population, the key to our further advance will be the degree to which we can lengthen the battlefield and invite onto the battlefield allies from abroad, from overseas, because that has been the key to our advance thus far.
Thank you so much, Professor Gerald Horn, author of the book I'm going to assign all readers to read before July 4th, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, published by NYU Press.
You are listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Coming up, Old Mo Variety Hour, 9 o'clock with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, talks about recent U.S. foreign policy. Ivan Hale has commentary about the community mental health and the challenges of helping highly volatile people. Bicycle activist Hart Necker and recent city council candidate Nick Caleb talk about the Petapalooza ride. And Eric DePlace of Sightline Institute talks about the proposed oil depot terminals on the Columbia. 10 o'clock, Chris Andre with Air Cascadia. 10:15, Chris Siegel, guest host Locus Focus. He'll speak to award-winning chef Dan Barber. 11 o'clock, Health Watch. Dr. Jeffrey Bland is the leader in functional medicine movement. At 11:30, Madness Radio, Erica Van Acker discusses her innovative counseling work with violent offenders in the Netherlands. And thank you all KBOO members for your generous support in our recent membership drive. And if you're not a member, you can still become one. Become one today by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Voices on the Ground, Resistance and Resilience, Friday and Saturday, June 6th and 7th at Portland State University. The keynote speaker will be Sherry Hunkala, a national activist in anti-poverty movements and co-founder of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights. This two-day conference will focus on areas of human rights, criminalization, and pathologizing of identities and experiences, revolutionary tools, and more. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the 27th Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival, July 3rd through 6th at Waterfront Park, which benefits Oregon Food Bank and features Greg Ullman, Boz Skaggs, Los Lobos, Maceo Parker, Bombino, Charlie Musselwhite, Ivan Neville's Dumpster Funk, and many more. Information, complete schedule, and pass information at waterfrontbluesfestival.com.
This boy got it so bad, he said he wished he was a mole in the ground. He got it bad. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. If I was a baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The time is just after 9 o'clock. I'm your host and engineer, Joe Clement. Every week, our moles examine and promote thinking.